60 seconds and counting. We are go for Apollo 7 at this time.
Alrighty, our third speaker of the day is among the world's leading researchers and historians on the UFO subject. He is the author of two volumes of History, UFOs and the National Security States, as well as an analysis of the future, AD after disclosure, when the government finally reveals the truth about alien contact. He has appeared on many radio and television shows, including specials for the History Channel, Sci-Fi, BBC, and elsewhere. Since 2012, he has hosted his own radio show. In his books, articles, and many interviews, he has analyzed the deconstruction of our political liberties as a result of the UFO cover-up, the possible nature of the non-humans themselves, what their presence mean for our civilization, why he believes the cover-up will end within our lifetime, and what is likely to happen after that. He has done some tremendous work on the subjects with deep and thorough analysis on the history of the UFO question. His work is very important to get a handle on just how many instances, encounters, sightings, and contact that the military around the world has had with these things, whatever or whoever actually is behind the UFO technology. His website is richarddolandpress.com. His talk today is called What's Up with the Breakaway Civilization? Please help me welcome Richard Dolan.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you. Thank you so very much. I'm going to try to speak as deliberately as I can. I know we have a little bit of an echo effect. Let me move this down here. I'm very happy to be here. So what is up with the breakaway civilization? That's a bit of an homage, incidentally, to the great Catherine Austin Fitz, who spoke here earlier today. She had a classic article called What's Up with the Black Budget. If you haven't read it, I suggest you go Google it and read it. It's great. I think of the UFO phenomenon as central to one of the great discrepancies of our era. I've been looking at this subject for about 20 years now. And it's filled with discrepancies. When you think about all of the ways in which it's significant to us, whether at a scientific level, what are these things? How do they zip around the sky in the way that they do? What can cause an object to zigzag and shoot straight up? That's pretty darn interesting. Or when you think of the political implications, that is, how is it that this phenomenon is being handled at certain levels which we don't normally have access to? That's a fascinating question. Statistics. If you were to go online and... Whoops, let's move this down a little bit. I'm afraid that I'm blasting you out with... Is this okay? Can you hear me like this? All right. If you go online to look for UFO sighting reports, let's say for 2013, the last full year, there's a couple of major websites you could go to, a few other sources that have some statistics on it. And for the U.S. and Canada alone, for last year, you would find roughly 15,000 reports, 15,000 UFO reports for 2013, for just U.S. and Canada. That's about 40 a day, 40 a day. And all, when you one considers that... maybe 1 out of 10 people, maybe if we're lucky, might report their sighting to some agency. You could easily multiply that by 10. It's not an outrageous assumption to think that there could very well be 150,000 UFO, genuine like UFO sightings. Now, of course, they're not all alien craft or even TR-3Bs, but some of them probably are. What's the ratio of legitimate sightings? No one knows. No one knows. But it's a lot. There might be 15,000 legitimate sightings of truly anomalous activity in our atmosphere just in North America every year. It's quite possible. Yeah. I'm going to fix that up. All right. I'm going to speak a little more quietly now. Okay. I just don't want to blast you out with the echo. All right, blast away. So maybe 15,000 genuine sightings a year. It's quite possible. Economic implications are profound, particularly when you factor in energy. After all, whatever these things use to move around, it's probably not petroleum. Right? And so that has tremendous implications for our global economic and financial structure. Philosophical issues, existential issues. What does it mean that there are perhaps some other agencies that are operating in our skies, in our oceans, in beyond the atmosphere? That's important for what we are as human beings. All of it, and personal. There are thousands upon thousands of individuals, many of you sitting here right now, who've had what you believe are intense personal encounters with some other, whatever that other is. This is a phenomenon that affects people at a very deep level. This is not trivial. So where's the discrepancy? Well, the discrepancy is that there's no love, there's no recognition from our mainstream culture. There's no recognition from our academic community. There's no recognition from our political institutions. It's a subject that gets no love, but it's significant. And that should tell us something right away. I look at it now as we're in a fence. You know, we're in this little enclosed fence in our little worldview that we're all supposed to believe. But just beyond that fence, there is something else. And in fact, it's not just these other visitors, whatever they are, but there's an infrastructure beyond that fence of ours. It's unacknowledged, and I think it's quite vast. So I want to look into it. It's not just in the atmosphere. It's down here on the ground. It's, I think, below the ground, probably. And I think it exists beyond Earth's orbit. There's something very, very significant going on. Before I get into the really strange stuff here with you today, I'll just put out the obvious remark that a number of other speakers here have already been discussing. And there's really no need for me to go over the same ground that they've been talking with you about, but simply that there are multiple space programs operating in a clandestine manner. I mean, think of it this way. A couple of years ago, there was the announcement that the United States, NASA was going to cease their manned operations in space, and all of this talk about the U.S. kind of shutting down its significant space-based operations and so forth. And that's a lot of nonsense. And it's nonsense because on a logical, practical basis, if the United States military establishment is going to continue to be the dog that has to pee on everyone's tree around the world and has to dominate this world in the way that it is accustomed to, it must dominate space as a theater of operation. There's no negotiation about that. Space must be under its control. And ipso facto, you must have a powerful presence of domination of space. That's not going to end, not voluntarily, not by them. These multiple programs, I'm going to suggest, are a combination of traditional technologies and revolutionary technologies. And this point was made yesterday by both Mark McCandlish and Michael Schratt, and others as well have been talking about this. So you've got your old-fashioned chemical technology that's still being used in one way or another, and you've got some very, very radical technologies, which I'll talk about. You know, back in olden times, during paperclip, a lot of those German scientists brought over were involved in the creation of what was called the dinosaur program, which was very, very instrumental and had, despite that it was supposedly canceled, left its own legacy and probably a secret space legacy that's been built on top of that. Back in the late 1980s, there was an announcement out of the blue in the New York Times that Vandenberg Air Force Base which had its own secret cadre of, I believe it was 32 astronauts at the expense of many billions of dollars. That was closed down because it was no longer practical in the aftermath of the Challenger explosion. And if you want to believe that, be my guest. These programs, in other words, they're canceled, quote unquote, after they've been in operation for some time when it's no longer convenient for people to think that these are still going on. But these things happen. We've got a number of instances in which clandestine space programs are hinted at or even acknowledged, and then they go away. Now let's go into the land of the strange. Ingo, what do you know about the moon? This is a story, I'm sure some of you are familiar with it, I'm sure many of you may not. Ingo Swann, who recently passed away, was one of the top remote viewers in the U.S. intelligence community back in the 1970s and 80s. And by the mid-1970s, he was already a legend. And the reason he was a legend is because Ingo Swann remote viewed Jupiter before our first probe, our space probe, ever reached it. Ingo was bored one day. He goes to his boss, Hal Puthoff, and says, I'm bored with remote viewing Soviet submarines all the time. Let's do something interesting. And Hal Puthoff said, well, what would you like to do? And they decided he was going to remote view Jupiter in advance of our first probe out there. What Ingo Swann did is he identified, I believe it was 13 specific data points about the planet Jupiter, none of which were known at the time, one of which included the existence of a planetary ring. Pretty nifty. And it was shortly after that that ring was confirmed. This made Ingo Swann highly coveted by all kinds of black world projects and programs who then would ask him to do remote viewing work for them. So he gets a phone call from a mysterious guy named Axelrod one day who says, I need you to be at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. tomorrow at noon. Ingo was in New York City at the time, and it was a 2 a.m. phone call. He says, well, okay, I'll be there. Takes a train down there and has this incredible cloak and dagger experience with these two twins who are very military. They look identical to each other. They don't speak. They communicate by cue cards. They take him into a vehicle, a car, where they blindfold him. He's not happy about this, but they go. They drive and drive and drive. They get out. They get into a helicopter. They go somewhere else. They land. He's still blindfolded. They go to a building after walking an enormous distance into an elevator, down, 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 down. Elevator doors open. Blindfold comes off, and here's Axelrod. And he pays Ingo a lot of money for the week, and he says, I'd like you to do some remote viewing for us. And the first question he says is, what do you know about the moon? Ingo Swann says, well, not a whole lot. Okay, well, here are 10 coordinates. I'd like you to remote view them. Ingo Swann does, and what does he see? He sees structures. He sees buildings. He sees people or beings. And as he sees them, he says, they're looking at me. Axelrod says, come away from there very quickly. He spends a week doing this. At the end of the week, he writes a detailed report about the efficiency of remote viewing, its strengths and limitations, and so forth. What was it that he was seeing on the moon? Well, it's not proof that he was seeing actual structures. I mean, remote viewing can be effective. It's not 100%. But Ingo Swann saw structures on the moon. And incidentally, it's my own opinion that the Axelrod operation was some form of counterintelligence. After all, let's just say you're not from here. And let's just say that your operation involves, among other things, telepathy, mind-to-mind communication. Just pretend it happened, because it might be the case. And these Americans are now creating this new remote viewing program. You might want to know how vulnerable you are. You might want to test these remote viewers. There's a lot of other things about the Ingo Swann Axelrod encounter that lead one to that conclusion. But the point for here is that Ingo Swann saw stuff, artificial things on the moon, including the far side of the moon. I'll tell you another story that came to me, a conversation that I had with another scientist involved in the remote viewing program back then, Russell Targ. Many of you know of him, and I'm sure some of you know him. A number of years ago, I had a phone conversation with Russell. It's a nice conversation. At one point, he said to me, "Richard, in the early to mid-1980s, I was tasked at one point to train remote viewers whose job was to remote view the far side of the moon." And these remote viewers were based out of Fort Meade, Maryland, by the way. So, remote view the far side of the moon. I said, "Well, Russell, why would they do that?" Long pause. He said, "Why do you think?" So I said, "All right, I'll bite. Were they looking for E.T.?" He said to me, "Yes, they were going to look for E.T. I said, "Did they find E.T. on the far side of the moon?" He said, "Ah, I don't know. That wasn't part of my assignment." So I don't know if he knows or not, but I believe Russell Targ. So here's the early 1980s. You've got a clandestine secret program tasking remote viewers to remote view the far side of the moon. Why? Well, looking for E.T. Why would they look for E.T. if they had absolutely no reason to think that they would find E.T. on the far side of the moon, right? And so it goes. We've had testimony from some very credible people. This is Carl Wolf. Carl Wolf was with Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project almost 15 years ago now. He's given some incredibly compelling, persuasive, consistent testimony about his own experience in 1965. He was a young guy. He had a top-secret crypto clearance at a Tactical Air Command at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. On one occasion that year, he was assigned to an NSA facility. He thought it was NASA, because he didn't know that what the NSA was in 1965. He thought they had said NASA, but it was an NSA facility to do some equipment repair. While he's there, he's talking with another airman about how they would obtain images, digital images, from the lunar orbiter. This is a totally new technology at the time. It was fascinating to him, and they're just chatting. And somehow, at one point, this other guy says, "Oh, by the way, we've discovered a base on the backside of the moon." Carl Wolf got frightened, and he's mentioned this many times in his interviews, because he knew he wasn't cleared for this information. He thought, this is not a good situation for me. I can get into a lot of trouble. The guy then brings out the mosaic. You know how they take the satellite images strip by strip and they put together this mosaic, and he's showing it to him. He's got it out there. And according to Carl Wolf, this mosaic showed all kinds of geometric shapes, towers, spherical buildings, something that he thought looked like radar dishes, large structures. And again, he was scared. It took him more than 30 years to come out and discuss this in the late 1990s. We have the testimony of another Disclosure Project witness, Donna Hare, also equally compelling. She had a secret clearance. This is early 1970s for a NASA subcontractor, Philco Ford, and was shown a satellite photograph of a distinct UFO, and had it explained to her that this technician's job was to airbrush any evidence of UFOs out of photographs for NASA before they were made public. She heard, this is secondhand, but seems to be legit, from other employees at the Johnson Space Center, that some of the astronauts had seen extraterrestrial craft on the moon. Now, this is in the early 70s, so the moon landings had taken place by then. She said, "I believe there were three of such craft on the moon when they landed." The code word for them was Santa Claus. And, of course, this is very much in line with the story that is attributed to Neil Armstrong. Michael Schratt mentioned this yesterday. This came from the author Timothy Good. I spoke with Timothy about this personally, and Timothy told me about the source of this. This is a woman who's a friend of his. She's no longer alive, unfortunately. Tim said to me she was as rock solid as you could ever get, and she essentially eavesdropped on a conversation that Neil Armstrong was having at an event where this other individual said, essentially, "So what really happened on the moon?" And Armstrong said, "Well, yes, we've been warned off." This is a paraphrase, but there were craft there. Enormous and menacing was the word he apparently used. Probably was enough to, you know, put the fear of God in someone. So these stories keep coming out. They don't stop. A gentleman named Vito Ceceri, back in the late 70s, had read a book by a fellow named George Leonard, Somebody Else is on the Moon. In fact, Ingo Swann wrote about this same book. So in 1979, he goes with another engineer, friend of his, and arranged to go to Houston's NASA headquarters and ask to see moon photos. NASA had a check with Langley, CIA, and they said, okay, you can do it. It was quite a surprise. Strict rules, he was allowed 3 days, 8-hour days, no writing, no recording devices, and he would not be allowed to be left alone with photos. So what does he see? This is Cecchieri's words. Obvious machinery on the surface showing bolted sections, a UFO rising from the surface and photographed directly above a crater. The unmistakable figure of a rectangular structure placed squarely in the biggest crater pictured, a perfect three-dimensional view. He also read a transcript from one of the Apollo missions. And the words, this is what they said. Houston, we've got a bogey at 2 o'clock. Roger that. Apollo switching to Alpha. Roll 8 degrees and begin sequence. Alpha and Bravo were two switching stations for secured or classified communications. So they continued the discussion on Alpha. In another mission, he reads, Mission Control, we got Santa Claus coming over the hill. Roger, Apollo, hold your fix, switching Bravo. Do you copy? Roger, Houston, Bravo Link. So what if this is true? What if there's a presence on the moon of a group that doesn't appear to be us? Just what if? Because that's what it looks like. If it were true, that would be a very, very important thing, wouldn't it? It would mean that this space program that the world was undertaking would be running into some potential obstacles. A great unknown kind of confrontation could be taking place. Would they be able to tell the rest of us about it? That's a real tricky thing to do. You know, with a program with as much attention as the moon landing programs got worldwide, how do you manage the secrecy on that? So let's just keep going a little bit. I received, I've got a few accounts of the what seems to be an ominous nature of whatever it is that's here. That's Jimmy Carter. I'll tell you that story in just a moment. What we have are a number of cases, a number of instances where information seems to have seeped out to researchers or other people indicating that this is a grave matter. The researcher Donald Kehoe, retired Marine Corps major, he's really one of the most prominent people doing this back in the 1950s and 60s and into the 70s. Kehoe was a guy who had a lot of contacts. And one of them in the 1960s made it very clear to him and said, and this is a paraphrase, and I was looking for the exact statement that I couldn't find in advance here, but this did happen. He said to Kehoe, this is something that is so serious. This can never, ever, ever come out. This is beyond anything you realize. You have no idea how deep this is, how serious this is. The Jimmy Carter story. Now, this came to me directly from a gentleman, and I'll tell you a little bit about this gentleman. I don't want to give up his name at this point. He's a known guy. Very brilliant man. Extremely, extremely intellectually meticulous man who's got the right connections into the White House and at the highest levels of the American national security structure. And I had a series of long conversations with him. And one thing he said to me was, it was known to him for sure that Jimmy Carter did receive a briefing on the matter of UFO/ET in June of 1977. Now, this man did not know exactly what was told to President Carter. This is early on in the Jimmy Carter administration. He had just been inaugurated a few months earlier. But what he did know, he said, was that at the conclusion of that meeting, President Carter was seen at his desk, elbows on the desk, head in his hands, and he was either sobbing or nearly sobbing. Something deeply upset President Carter. What was that something? I speculated with this gentleman. I said, well, can we assume that he was told this was a very serious matter? He said, yes. I said, can we assume that he might have been told he doesn't really have a whole lot of operational control over this matter? He said, absolutely yes. Another story that came to me, and in fact we wrote about this, my co-author and I, in AD After Disclosure a couple of years ago, had to do with a man who was first administration of the Reagan presidency, comes into office as an undersecretary in 1981. Shortly after he came into office, some very close friends of his, who had been friends back in California where he was from, visit him. And among them was a young man who was 19 years old at the time, close friend of the family, kind of grew up with this undersecretary's family. You know, they're very, very tight. So it's now 2 a.m., a couple of drinks, and this undersecretary was becoming very, very upset and maybe a little loose-lipped, and he's talking one-on-one with this young man who's kind of like an extra son of his. And it came out that after he had... the first thing that he did as undersecretary is he spent 2 weeks at a very secure underground facility, being briefed on a lot of things, and including UFO ET presence on Earth. And all that he would say to this young man was that it was deeply upsetting to him. And the reason it was upsetting to him is that he had a daughter to raise in this world. No more details. We have a statement that came from Ben Rich, head of Lockheed's Skunk Works. And, of course, Ben Rich, everyone knows who Ben Rich was. this came through a gentleman named Bill McDonald. Bill's still around. I've chatted with Bill many times. Bill talked with John Andrews, who was, again, mentioned repeated a lot of times yesterday in the talks. John Andrews, very, very prominent, close friend of Ben Rich. The story is that Ben Rich told John Andrews that the public must never be told about the true reality of what's going on with this. It was unbelievable, he said. It was too intense, it was too powerful, it was too dramatic, too frightening. What would make these people have this reaction? What would be the most likely reaction? Well, one of the things that you would do, and in particular, if we would want to build what they have, they're clearly vastly beyond anything that we've got here. And in particular, if you've collected any of their material, would we want to be studying their technology? Well, I think the answer is obviously yes. I've been saying this for years to students who are interested in the black budget phenomenon, which is that if you don't really understand the centrality of the UFO phenomenon to the black budget, then you're missing a huge part of this picture. And I would not go so far as to suggest that UFOs are the only thing to create our black budget culture. But I would suggest that they were a key initiator in getting that whole culture started. Because when you go back to the 1940s and you put yourself in the position of the U.S. hierarchy, Harry Truman and all the guys around him, and they've got this utterly awesome piece of information that's dropped into their laps. This is right after the end of the Second World War. You've got completion of the most titanic struggle in global history just being done. Millions of homeless people, millions on the brink of starvation, a new Cold War erupting, and now you've got this. What do you do with this? Do you really tell the world? Of course you don't. You can't. A, you don't know who you're dealing with. B, you don't know how bad the panic's going to be. C, you don't, if you've gotten any technology, any freebies, you may not want to share it with rivals, and you may not want to share it with the general public, particularly if it's going to change your whole energy paradigm. That's a lot to think about all in one fell swoop. No, what you would do is you'd get your best people around you, and you'd say, we're going to figure this out. We're going to put our team together. And we're going to find out how to study this technology. We're going to find out how bad the public panic might be if we reveal this. We're going to find out who these other beings are and all of the logical questions. And then we're going to find out a way how to fund covertly all of the research and development that will be necessary to study this phenomenon and to implement the correct security measures as well. All of that. And as I think we can all recognize, secrecy develops its own momentum, its own profit, its own bureaucracy, its own reason to be. And then the next thing you know, it's got you, and you have no escape from it. And the longer it goes, the more difficult it becomes to let this secret out openly without your whole house of cards falling down. There's a researcher back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s, but really Leonard Stringfield got the ball rolling with crash retrieval phenomenon with the publication of that book, Situation Red. That was in the late 1970s, very beginning of the Carter years. Jimmy Carter, by the way, of course, the first U.S. presidential candidate to openly admit that he'd seen a UFO, got a lot of news at the time, and in fact, a lot of people thought, this could be the opportunity for some real openness on UFOs. And Carter was asked a number of times as a candidate, if you're president, would you try to release any UFO data? And Carter said, yes, if I'm elected president, I will look into this as long as it doesn't adversely affect national security, et cetera, et cetera. So there was this hope when Jimmy Carter became elected that there might be some forward motion on this topic. At the same time, Stringfield publishes this book, and this book referred to possible retrievals of non-human technology. There's a lot more than just Roswell in this whole story. And in particular, in the late 70s, researchers started to collect them. And I think the reason was, first of all, Stringfield's book opened the door, and many of the people who came to him really seemed to have believed that President Carter was just about to make some kind of announcement anyway. And I thought, good, I'm going to come to you. And boy, did they come to Leonard Stringfield. Just a couple of these stories. Oops. Because I don't really think people have a full flavor of what Stringfield collected. And I know what this is like now as a researcher myself when people come to me with different stories of encounters that they've had. And Stringfield just became the clearinghouse. He was the magnet for a long time. Some incredible stories. One, retrieval in somewhere in the southwestern U.S. in 1957, not 1947, four humanoid bodies recovered with great difficulty. There was a doctor based out of New York City that Stringfield got to know fairly well who talked to him about having autopsied an alien body or bodies. One witness who said he saw 9 alien bodies at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the 1960s, 4 feet tall, was told that there were 30 such bodies at the base, that there was a craft at the base, and said at certain military bases, there were mobile units in constant readiness to recover downed objects, downed UFOs, and on and on and on. There was one radar specialist, this is from 1953, this is a fascinating one to me, who told Stringfield he was shown a film of a crashed UFO from a desert location which showed the interior of the craft and dead aliens inside a tent. Now, if you remember the 1990s film of the alien autopsy video by Ray Santilli, which everyone said, that's a hoax, that's whatever. What a lot of people don't realize is that these stories had been circulating for quite some time. That is, military people saying, don't know why, but I was shown this very strange film of an alien autopsy or of a recovery of a UFO with dead aliens. My own theory on this is goes like this. Let's say I'm an officer and I'm in charge of managing this program, and every now and then I have to recruit and bring new people into my program to manage, to deal with this, you know, highly sensitive subject. So I've got to look for my people, and I identify maybe a couple of people here, but I don't really know how they're going to react to this when they encounter the information. So we do a little test run. In the case of this particular guy who spoke to Stringfield, I think he failed the test because 2 weeks after he was shown the film, he said an officer on base came up to him and said, that movie you saw, forget it, it was a hoax. The guy was totally mystified. That was 1953. In any case, there's a lot of these, lots and lots of these stories that Stringfield collected. But wait, there's more. One of my favorite, and I think one of the most important stories in all of UFO research has to do with these three individuals right here. Wilbert Smith, Robert Sarbacher, and Dr. Eric Walker. Wilbur Smith was a kind of a genius. He was a Canadian scientist who was in the bureaucracy of the Canadian Department of Transportation. Kind of a mid to upper level guy there who just happened to be fascinated by the flying saucer phenomenon back in the 1950s. And on one occasion in 1950, he was down in Washington, D.C., and met up with, through the Canadian embassy, had a couple of interviews with some prominent Americans, including a mysterious scientist. And Smith wrote about this in a classified memo at the time to his bosses, at which he said that he was told that the UFO subject was the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rating higher even than the H-bomb. 1950, the H-bomb was about as high as you would go. This was higher. So that document was released many years later after Wilbur Smith had died. And no one really knew who he spoke to until another researcher named Arthur Bray went through the Smith papers and found Smith's handwritten notes from that meeting in September 1950. And he saw the name Robert Sarbacher, Dr. Robert I. Sarbacher. Well, Sarbacher himself was a brilliant young scientist with the defense establishment back in the 50s, very well positioned. And it was Sarbacher who had said this to Smith. Sarbacher, in the early 80s, when all of this was found out, was still alive. And a number of researchers got to Robert Sarbacher, who then sung like a canary, confirmed everything that Smith had said, and then wrote a two-page, single-spaced, typed memo to another researcher in which he really laid it out. He said, yes, I was very aware of crash retrievals, of exotic technologies coming from these other beings. He said the word was that they seemed to be constructed something like insects. This is a letter from 1983. This letter made the rounds in the intelligence community, by the way. Well, it didn't end there because more research, and Sarbacher died like a year after this. He didn't live much longer after this whole thing came out. Before he died, he gave the name of another guy, another top scientist who was involved, he said absolutely was involved in this, and that's Dr. Eric A. Walker. Who is Eric Walker? Well, Eric Walker was more than just the president of Penn State University, which is not a bad gig to have, but Eric Walker was the chair of one of the most elite defense think tanks in the country, the Institute for Defense Analyses, the IDEA. And this was written about at length, incidentally, in a book that I was lucky to be able to publish for the authors Grant Cameron and Scott Crane. It's an excellent book. You can look for this. They did a great analysis of this. In any case, Walker was found, and he first spoke in 1987 about this, right after the MJ-12 documents were released and all of this messy controversy about their authenticity was being discussed. Whatever reason, who knows why, Eric Walker thought, I'll talk a little bit about this. And he confirms to the researcher, yes, he was involved in these meetings. Yes, there is a group like Majestic 12. He says, I've known about them for 40 years. He says to the researcher, you'd better back away from this. You're getting into stuff you have no idea. The researcher says, no, I do, and I'm doing this because I believe in it, et cetera, et cetera. Walker says, you know, you have no idea. It's a series of fascinating discussions. And shortly after this, Walker decided to shut it down. He just avoided everyone because I think he realized he'd probably said too much. It's a heck of a lineage there of conversations that gives us more reason to think something's going on. Journalist James Goodall, very well known among some UFO researchers. He was not a UFO guy per se, but he certainly knew a lot about it. Did a lot of work as a journalist with people involved in Groom Lake, Area 51 region, all of that, classified technologies and so forth. Long before the world heard of Bob Lazar, James Goodall was working the same turf. It was his own conclusion, this is back circa 1990, that there were at least 8 black programs flying out of Groom, not counting the B-2, not counting the known classified programs that had come out, but beyond that, including a silent flying triangle. So we're talking, 25 years ago or more. One of his guys at Groom, who was there for 12 years, Goodall says, do you believe in UFOs? Guy says, absolutely, positively they exist. Can you expand on that? No. guy later said, and this is a quote that I think everyone should know about, we have things in the Nevada desert that would make George Lucas envious. And one of his other sources, this is from 1985 or so, said, we have things out there that are literally out of this world, better than Star Trek or anything you can see in the movies. Goodall says, can you expand on that? The guy says, no. There's an interesting article I just saw about a week or so ago by a fellow named Harry Howard. I need to check in more into him, but he seems to have been an intelligence officer who briefed the very famous General George S. Brown during Vietnam. Basically, it was his own analysis, his own take on the subject, that the black triangles are an integral part of the secret space fleet. He says, you know, absolutely, obviously exist, and certainly they do. And again, another book that I was fortunate to publish about a year ago by David B. Marler, really the definitive study on flying triangles, called Triangular UFOs, An Estimate of the Situation, lays out just how powerful this evidence is for the reality of truly revolutionary triangular UFOs. Now, they don't behave in any way like ordinary aircraft. They're out there. Well, this is Howard's conclusion. Calls them the greatest development in the history of mechanical devices since the invention of the wheel. Well, maybe. It's an interesting analysis, and I think I rather like it. And you can look it up, called Black Triangles, Cornerstone of the USA Space Fleet. So here's the problem. So if we create these revolutionary technologies, whatever they're based on, free energy or some kind of electrogravitic propulsion system, isn't that really going to like totally transform human society? Wouldn't that totally, or at least largely, liberate humanity in so many critically important ways? And let's just think about some of these implications. Free energy or some version of energy that's significantly better than pulling petroleum out of the ground, the source of nearly every significant war that we've been having for the last century or more. I think it'd be a very, very liberating experience for humanity. But won't it also challenge the current structure of wealth and power here on planet Earth? That's a problem for these people who are sitting at the top of the human food chain, and they're not necessarily willing to rock that boat. So what does this require? It's a system that requires a black budgets. Catherine earlier today talked at length about black budgets. Black budgets are more than just your classified federal tax dollars at work. Black budgets are more than simply, U.S. citizens paying for military programs that they have no knowledge about, they have no control over, that are doing God knows what, with the barest, thinnest veil of a pretext in their name, which is, of course, not on their behalf at all. It's more than that. Because if you need to, raise secret armies, overthrow governments, illegally rig elections, or build a secret space fleet, you're going to need a lot of money. You're going to need a lot more money than simply federal tax dollars. And you also want money that's not so easily trackable and traceable that you don't have to answer to. So where do you get that money from? Well, you get it through financial shenanigans, financial fraud. You get it through narco-trafficking money. Narco-trafficking is probably a top five industry in the world. Probably. It's right up there. Simply because drug trafficking is illegal doesn't mean that no one wants the money, because everybody wants that money. Everyone would like free money, particularly these agencies. I had a conversation with another gentleman. One day I'll put all these names out there. Some of my researcher colleagues know who I'm talking about. One gentleman who had a lot of knowledge of how a lot of this worked out, and made a very salient point to me, which was that the money going into these research and development programs related to this subject was enormous. He didn't give me a figure. But he said, think about this. No matter how enormous it is, the amount of money for the security on this program exceeds it by a factor of 7 or 8 times. So I'm thinking, well, what does that mean? This is a little more than guys with guns. We're talking, although that's part of it, we're talking maybe the construction of underground infrastructure facilities, the cost of managing and controlling the media, the cost of controlling political operatives that are prominent in the system. I can imagine that there's a lot of expenses going into this to contain this. So that was his insight. So you need black budgets. And what that, of course, requires, what that means is, at least constitutionally, in terms of legality, in terms of what this country likes to tell ourselves what we're supposed to be, this is a complete overthrow of what the United States is supposed to be about. This is a fundamental moment where accountability must not be open. It must not be transparent. Rightly or wrongly, I think wrongly, these people decided that this topic is vastly too important to be able to entrust to the general public. It's too serious, it's too dark, it's too threatening from their point of view. So you create black budgets and you essentially create a coup d'etat. That's what it is. It's a silent coup that takes place. And it took place by degrees, but fundamentally it took place, I would say, in the 1940s. And it deepened and deepened and deepened. As a result, obviously, financial corruption. It's more than just black budgets. It's an entire manipulation of the global financial system to hide this reality. There are a series of labyrinthian-like financial cutouts, you know, phony offices and offices nested within other offices within others, so that even the greatest accountants in the world would have a hard time figuring out the paper trail. And of course, when you get into a situation like that, you got a lot of free money for everyone who's able to just plunder at will. So it's a situation where it's not simply they're all on the up and up saying, well, we have to have this secret program so that people don't know. No, it's a situation where, yes, we'll have this secret program that people don't know about, and let's rob them in the process. So that's been going on since this whole thing started. Tremendous deep corruption in which, of course, blackmail is the norm. And again, I'm referencing Catherine here, but she's talked quite eloquently about this a number of times. The fact that if you get to a certain position of power in this country, or I would assume any country, but in this country, you'll end up having a sit-down with NSA or CIA or FBI, and they will tell you, they will know, they've got the goods on you, and you'd better behave, or they'll destroy you. They'll make it very clear. These politicians, they may get into this field because of idealism at one point or another, but they very quickly learn if they get any kind of power whatsoever, they are owned outright by other interests. And that's what they have to work for. And they're controlled. They're controlled through blackmail and through bribery and everything else that influences people. Political corruption. This whole system predicated on black budgets, financial corruption, political corruption. Classification of the technologies, holding our future hostage. So think of it this way. You've got a group of privatized, black budget scientists, security people. They control this radical technology that they are studying. This is really where I kind of conceived of the idea of a breakaway civilization. This is something that I mentioned first in UFOs and the National Security State's second volume about 5 years ago. I'm glad I coined that phrase, and I'm very gratified that other researchers have found that it's you know, something worth following up on, and I'm very, very gratified that other researchers are trying to study the analytics and the structure of this. You know, we need a lot of people looking into this. In any case, what happens with these classifications of the technologies is, let's say we're part of that group. We're the scientists. And we come up with our breakthroughs. You know, we'll come up with, yes, money makers, better integrated circuits, lasers, fiber optics, and the rest. Those are nice ground floor investment opportunities for sure. But we may come up with something a little bit niftier than that. We may come up with electrogravitics that actually work, something that can give you true gravity reduction. We may come up with a new form of energy, better than petroleum. Of course, we can't let the rest of the world know about that. That's off limits. We wouldn't be allowed to, because our bosses, the private interests that fund our operation, would say, no, 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 can't do that. So what would we do? We would simply classify those technologies, and there are thousands upon thousands of classified patents along these lines in the U.S., and one of the gentlemen in this research field, Thomas Vallone, worked at the U.S. Patent Office for years, and he's spoken about this at length. Tom Vallone's one of the best experts on electrogravitics out there as well. So you've got a whole series of classified technologies that are off limits to us. And as I say, it holds our future hostage. So if you were smart enough to come up with your own version of electrogravitics and you wanted to patent it, I think you'd have a hard time getting that thing patented. You'd be running into some classified stuff. And incidentally, this is a key reason why there's now a movement, I'm jumping a little bit ahead of myself, but not too much, but a key reason why there's this global rush right now to solidify a transnational legal structure. You know, not just NAFTA, not just the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement with Europe, and not just with the TPPA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. The whole thing's coming into place right now. And one of the key things that they feel that they must do is nail down intellectual property rights so that if some genius person in India or China or some other place comes up with a nice electrogravitic system, that too says, no, 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 you're going into classified territory, proprietary. That's the whole point. You classify it to keep that fence around us in place for as long as possible and as strongly as possible. But you have to do more than that. This whole system requires a comprehensive approach. It requires control over the media, and I mean total control over the media. Totally, significant total control. So, sure, you can allow, some cable station to put out a UFO documentary that talks a little bit about this. It's best if you get the kind of he said, she said documentary where you put a little bit of one side of out there and then you bring in a couple of skeptics and they say, no, that's all nonsense. That's being objective, they like to think. And they'll put a little bit of that out there for the people because they know people are becoming more and more interested because we're living in a totally revolutionary era right now. But over the main media, over the establishment media, that's totally controlled. We all know this. It's funny, when I started researching this subject exactly 20 years ago, I'm sure many of you remember, it was a much harder sell, even then, crazy as it sounds, but it was a much harder sell to convince people that our media was as totally controlled as it is. I don't think it's a hard sell anymore. I think we've kind of gone through all of that. I think most people, even people beyond this room here, even people beyond those who may be watching this on YouTube, they know that there is a vast control over media. And one of the reasons, not the only, but one important reason that this media must be controlled is for this subject. It's essential. Not only the presence of others, but the fact that we have been developing a profoundly advanced infrastructure that is being kept away from ordinary people. Media must be controlled. Global totalitarianism. I've been thinking a little bit about this lately, and I think my opinion now is that it is seen as a necessary component of maintaining this system of secrecy. You can't just have it as a partial thing. You have to have total control. We've moved into a global world. We're trading with each other every single day around the world. We're all relying on each other in critical ways every single day around the world. So you must have a system in place, they feel, of having total control, a totalitarian system, literally totalitarian. And this is exactly what's being planned for. It's exactly, what they're working on. In short, this system must be predicated on everything that we're seeing in our world today. We're seeing the results of it now. Which means that there's, from that point of view, there's no way that those people who have got control over this secret, there's no way that they can ever undo secrecy over this program. Not in their opinion. And this is why for years I've characterized disclosure as a paradox. You know, I've always said it's impossible, but on the other hand, I continue to maintain that it's also inevitable. But the reason it's impossible is partly because of what I've just described to you here. This is very deeply entrenched in our world. And, you know, it's one of these things where when I look back on my 20 years now in this field, how astonished I am at the journey that I've gone through, in the sense that I started out 20 years ago with a very simple question. It wasn't even, are UFOs real? I wasn't even at that level. My question was so simple. It was this subject something that the national security community in the U.S. truly cared about ever? Because if they cared about it, why had I never read about it in any academic history book ever? I mean, why would that not be interesting? 1950, go back in time, you got the Korean War breaking out, you've got the end of the Berlin airlift, all of this Cold War drama, you got Harry Truman dealing with all these problems, and then what, flying saucers? Were they actually interested in this? Well, it turns out, yeah, they were. And I thought, well, you know, wow. So that was the crowbar for me that just allowed me to pry open. That was the first level and the most important level. Before that, I was in as much of a conventional mindset as you know, many other people. I thought I was ahead of the curve because I had been reading, Noam Chomsky, and I thought, well, hey, that's good for me. Yeah, well, you know, it was 20 years ago. But what happens, of course, is that one answer leads to a dozen more questions, and each of those leads to many more. So one of the immediate questions that I started with was, wow, if this was a concern, why was it a concern? Well, it turns out it was a concern because you have declassified documents. They're not arguable. I've talked about them in many other venues. There's no need to go into it here. You can look at some of my other lectures on YouTube, whatever, or other researchers. But there's an overwhelming abundance of declassified documents that make it crystal clear that there were violations of sensitive airspace over key American and also international bases going way back, all the way back. And if you were in charge of air defense over your particular sensitive base, which may have had nuclear ordnance there, which happened many times, and you've got objects hanging out there and zipping around and totally evading your best interceptors, well, yeah, do you think you'd be a little bit interested in it? I think you would. And so would your bosses. So this we have. There's no argument about this. That's a fact. You can take that to the bank. But that led me further still. Oh, my goodness. You know, if this is real, then what were their thoughts about what they were dealing with? Did they think this was Russian? Did they think this is a black budget American program? Well, all of those questions were asked. All the logical questions that you could think being asked were asked. They were smart people. Now, unfortunately, all that we have available to us officially are lower level declassified documents. We don't really have the highest level. Those are the ones that are blacked out or that don't even get released. What we have are mid-level, like secret, confidential, restricted. And they're interesting, and they give us a pretty good idea about what some of the lower rungs were talking about. And they were very concerned. And every time they came up with a truly radical conclusion, like interplanetary visitors, the phrase of the time, they got shut down and dispersed. Obviously, those conclusions were not desired. Anyway, I'm digressing a little bit, but I just want to point out how strange this subject is. It leads to more and more questions. This, to me, and this is really why I just did my latest book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, which is really my attempt to encapsulate the whole field in something like a comprehensive way. And what you find is that this truly is the most revolutionary subject that you can imagine here on planet Earth. I think that it is. I think the UFO reality. And think about how this subject is handled within even the alternative research community at large. The UFO phenomenon gets kind of a strange position there, where a lot of alternative researchers, they're afraid to get into this subject. I've spoken to so many of them privately, and they're fascinated by it, but they will not go there publicly because it's just too much. It's too much of a ridicule factor. It's too much of a distraction. It's too much. They get into the crosshairs of the media, and it's just too much work for them. So what does that tell you? Well, it tells you that this is the gold mine of the alternative subject. This really is it. This is the core. After Bryce Zabel and I finished writing AD After Disclosure, it became obvious to us why this subject was enveloped in secrecy, because we realized when we looked at the implications of the end of UFO secrecy, it was obvious to us that this turns everything upside down. Everything upside down, whether you're politics, short-term or long-term geopolitics, your science revolutionizes your science, will cause probably a political revolution. You think of Occupy Wall Street. How about Occupy Area 51? Occupy Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I mean, right. You think it wouldn't happen? Of course it would happen. Of course it would happen. Once this ever came out, there'd be a lot of angry people who would be thinking, hey, wait a minute, you really lied. What's the status of these black budget programs that must obviously exist? And on and on and on. And what's the structure of the secrecy? How are you able to hose us over for so many years and lie to us and steal our money for so many years? I mean, there's people who have a dog-like obedience to authority who would never, ever, you know, say boo about it. And they think, well, you know, our leaders know best. But there's a lot of people who wouldn't be like that. There'd be a lot of people who'd be very angry. So this whole system is so unstable right now. It's so incredibly ready to just go, psh, that, well, we're on the verge of seeing something big. So that's why it's a paradox. The secret keepers will never voluntarily give this up. They have way too much to lose. Way too much to lose. On the other hand, as I've often said, they're not the only part of the equation. And the biggest dynamic part of the equation, frankly, is us and all of you sitting here in this audience. You know, like we know, power is never given. It has to be taken. And when people decide to take power, that's when real change will happen. We're seeing a dramatic shift culturally in relation to a lot of things in our society. But this one, I'm seeing it happen. I'm seeing a shift in general public attitude toward the subject of UFOs and a greater acceptance. And not simply from the general public, but also from a lot of intellectuals and academicians who are quietly, some of them are here, by the way, who are quietly interested and researching this and also making waves within their fields. There's a lot of change afoot. And, you know, we've only had WikiLeaks for 10 years. 10 years. Because we couldn't have it more than 10 years ago, because our global infrastructure couldn't accommodate WikiLeaks. Well, we can now. It's like the field of dreams. If you build it, they will come. If you create the infrastructure, boom, there it is. And now we are in an era where people can grab digital data and throw it out there for the world, whether legally or not, is irrelevant. It's irrelevant. People are doing it. It's a permanent part of the structure of our world now. It's never going to go away. And what we really have is, what do people really ever want? You know, the real war we're having is a war between forces for a global police state to control everything and the people. What do people want? People want one thing. They want to be free. It's the only thing we really want. We want to be free to do our thing. We're like water, and we're going to find our way to the path around those restrictions. So when you have a situation where now, you know, governments read our emails, we know that. Governments will find ways of dealing with us through intimidation and so on. People are resisting, and they are going to continue to find ways around this system. That's the true Cold War that's going on in the world today. That's the struggle. So I don't think this is totally a matter of faith on my part. I think that there's really genuine reason to believe that the people, we're not dead yet. I don't think we're ever going to be dead. So we're dramatically transforming our society now. What are we going to look like in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now? In terms of new technologies, new ways for us to communicate with each other, share information. It's not a slam dunk, but it can happen. Oh, and incidentally, this whole system that's been created, this whole movement for a global police state, for global total control, who owns it? Well, not the president, not the national security staff. It's owned by the banks, it's owned by private interests who stand behind the whole system. And I really think it's fair to say that they are the true breakaway civilization. You know, yeah, well, you I say now, the idea of a breakaway civilization initiated with me, anyway, in a technological way. You know, basically the black budget world on steroids with exotic alien technology, presumably alien technology, tossed in. You know, I talked a few times about a conversation I had with a former civilian scientist at NSA who said to me circa 1965, 64, that the NSA had a computer running at clock speeds of 650 megahertz, which, you know, it's no great shakes today, but was 35 years ahead of the consumer market, which did not reach that speed till 2000. And in 1965, there were no personal computers anyway. So NSA was 35 years ahead on that basis of the rest of the world in computing power. You could see it that way. So now you toss in exotic technology. You toss in classification of those technologies, preventing people from getting, and that gets you into a breakaway civilization where you've got technology that's unavailable to anyone else. And that's really what made me think of that. But what's happening here? You can't stop with simply the technology. You got to see who's running it, who owns it. And as we can see in all factors of our political system, all of the power stands behind. We all know this. And it's with multinational banks. It's with those people who have the pinnacle. They're at the pinnacle of wealth and power in this world. Yeah, and they'll go to the Bilderberg meetings, and they'll go to the trilaterals, and then they're in the CFR. And they go to Bohemian Grove and places like that. It's not just one place where they go. They're the rich country club. As George Carlin once said, it's a big club and you ain't in it. You and I ain't in it. So that's the system that they are putting in place. So within that whole scenario, you have to wonder, are there even discussions at that level about ever disclosing the reality of this insane reality that they are living in? A world in which there are these others, a world in which there's this incredible technology by us and by not us. Would they ever do it? Well, I think they do still have these discussions, and this is an interesting thing to ponder. Another conversation I had with a gentleman. This is the same guy who told me about the money going into these programs and the fact that the security is much more expensive than the scientific R&D. Well, the same man said to me, every 5 years or so, that was his words, there are meetings and discussions held at the highest levels of the political structure that bring this topic up. Should we disclose this reality or not? I mean, I don't think it's on like a schedule, like every 5 years, but he gave me this kind of like casual indication that it comes up every so often, maybe once or twice a decade, that type of thing. And in fact, this man had been on one subcommittee dealing with that, and even though he was a scientist, his subcommittee had to do with legal implications. Who knows why? They decided that, at least from a legal point of view, this was a nightmare. I mean, think about the lawsuits that would occur, even from just defense contractors. One defense contractor having access to ET technology, that's unfair trade practices, isn't it? That could be a nasty little lawsuit. I mean, that's such a mundane thing, but it was instructive, you know, that they were pondering some of these issues. So anyway, the fact that this comes up every so often, I mean, my head reels at the thought. When you think about how explosive this is, you'd have to ask yourself, why would it even come up at all? Why? Wouldn't this just be permanently off limits? And yet it doesn't seem to be so. And the only reason I can think of is that this is a very, very powerful, pressure-filled reality. And I don't think there's any ruling elite in history that's ever been totally unified. There are always factions, and I think that there are factions relating to this one, this subject as well, this most important, most revolutionary, transformative of subjects. few years ago, back in 2008, I did a conference in southwestern Illinois near the town of Galena. Cool place, by the way, beautiful. Still retains a lot of its 19th century look. Ulysses S. Grant lived in Galena, Illinois. And my very good friend Sam Maranto organized an event there, and I was there. And one night there were a fellow with a couple of pairs of excellent quality night vision binoculars. So we decided we were going to do a night watch. And I was there with a really nice group of people. It was just a couple of hours from 11 till a little after 1 a.m. Nice June evening in 2008. And I have to say, now we have, we may be doing some night vision here at this event, I know. I was blown away by what I saw. It was my first experience going through night vision in any kind of sophisticated way. And I couldn't monopolize the binoculars the whole night, although I wanted to, but we all shared. In 2 hours, I probably saw about literally 100 objects going through the night sky that I would not have been able to see with the naked eye. And I can't remember exactly now, but a very high percentage of these were really strange things. So, objects, super high altitude, going at unbelievably fast speeds. These were not meteorites. These were not space objects. These were craft of some sort. Many of them were pulsating in a very rhythmical way, going at speeds that just astonished me. You've had for years and years, and again, Michael Schratt did a fantastic discussion on some of these types of advanced craft, what are often known as trans-atmospheric vehicles. I don't know, take you to New York to Tokyo in a couple of hours, is it possible? Well, after that night, I thought, yeah, I think so. I think they're out there. There were objects that were, that seemed to be maneuvering. It was hard because we weren't recording anything and you're watching with, through these binoculars and sometimes they're moving kind of quickly. What I can tell you is it was like, that movie, They Live, where you put the special glasses on and you see the reptilian people behind the mask. Well, it was kind of like that, except that's what night vision does to the sky. It allows you to see a vastly different reality than what you would see, even on a clear night. You can see much, much more. And so that really got me, that had certainly got my attention. I'm going to show you just a couple of night vision clips here. This one was also from 2008, December, from Fremont, California, here out on the West Coast. I only included like a 30-second clip, and this includes what certainly appears to be a triangle. I'm going to start it now, and hopefully we'll be good here. There we go. So I should chat with Mark McCandlish or Michael Schratt about what they think this is. This is a TR-3 or maybe some other kind of triangular craft. It's something that's not supposed to be out there. That's a picture of it. That's a pretty good shot. You can see what it is. It's very, very clear. Maneuvering. I just did a fascinating nearly month-long tour of Canada. Did a 12-city lecture tour. It just ended a couple of weeks ago, and we ended up in Vancouver. I went from Halifax on the East Coast, 4,000 miles in an RV where you feel every bump along the way, ending up in Vancouver. It was a great adventure for me, and I'm glad I did it. The folks in Vancouver, they got a fascinating group of interested people out there, I'll tell you that. Some very, very good researchers, a lot of experiencers, witnesses, and just a lot happening out there. Of course, it's a beautiful city, and hey, if I were an ET that looked a little human, that might be a place I'd like to go, for sure. But there's a lot happening there. I had a long conversation after I came home with a Vancouver guy who does a lot of night vision there, too. And I'm just going to show you a couple of his clips. His name is Charles. You're going to see this in a moment. Look at this. Charles Lemieux. You can see a hole in the middle of this thing. This is only visible with night vision. And this is a little speeded up so you can see the movement of it a little more easily. There you go. One more here that Charles shot. This is just from a month ago. Don't know what this is. It looks like an orb. He was convinced this, that what you're about to see was not like an insect or not a close object. This is, you know, I mean, I don't know for sure. I don't know what this thing was, but you can take a look here. Watch this thing. That's the end of that. You know, the fact is, we have Ed Grimsley here, and Ed's very well known for doing night vision watches. And go online, go on YouTube. You can see a lot of this. There's a tremendous amount of very interesting night vision shots of strange happenings in the sky. And again, I'm mentioning it here because it seems to me that it's a very apt visual, kind of a visual representation of the world that we're in. In other words, just on the other side. Just on the other side of our apportioned field of vision of what we're allowed to see, there's this, it's an infrastructure. Is it ours or not ours? Well, my feeling is it's both. This is a research associate of mine, a friend, actually, who lives in central Arkansas. This lady's used Generation 3 night vision for a couple of years now, and she wrote to me. I'll just read it. She says, there are all kinds of craft up there. Military R&D drones, drone triangles, and even what she called a huge rectangular craft. She saw this in daylight. This wasn't night vision. She writes, I have seen these craft cloak. I saw one cloak over my house at treetop level, and I tell you, it could not be seen at all. And I was only about 50 yards away. I've also seen these drones from less than 30 feet, and there is no movement, no vibration, nothing. They look as though they are glued to the sky. But there are anomalies not simply all around us, right next door to us. By the way, that individual, I know her fairly well at this point, and I consider her a very reliable, very conscientious person. A couple of interesting anomalies. Some of these are somewhat well known. This is on YouTube. It's a very quick clip. I wrote about this in one of my volumes of history. This is the STS-51A sighting. This is 1984. And you're going to see a spherical object come toward the camera and go up. Here it is. And you'll see it in reverse. Now, I've done my own analysis, such as it is, of this object, basically trying to measure it, you know, the change in its size as it gets seemingly closer to the camera, and it does get larger. So the diameter of this thing does increase measurably from when it first appears to when it last appears. So it grows in its diameter as it gets closer to the camera, which tells me that this is something that's significant. It's not just some effect or some reflection or anything like that. A couple of years ago, I had a discussion with this about this object with Dr. Bruce Maccabee, who's an optical physicist and one of the more established experts in photographic analysis, video analysis of UFOs. Bruce was kind of noncommittal about it. He said, "Yes, it's interesting. Don't know what it was. It could be a reflection or something like that." But I don't think so. I don't think it is. To me, I think it shows that it's moving directly toward the camera, and it's something. And by the way, in addition to simply video evidence, there's a tremendous amount, or let us say a good amount, of observational evidence coming from American and Russian astronauts, cosmonauts, over the years. Quite a few of those stories. This is one. This is a real head scratcher. It's from the STS-140 mission from August 2005. This was on the website of the late Jeff Challender. I knew Jeff. I met him on one occasion. He died, unfortunately, in 2007, very suddenly. Jeff had a disability. It was hard for him to get out of the house, and he spent really his whole many years pulling down NASA video and recording it and then analyzing it. And he had a website. In fact, I need to re-upload it. I have permission to host his site. It was called Project Prove. I'm doing a whole website revamp myself this summer, and I'll have his back up, and you can look at this again and many others. But look at this clip. This is from the STS-114 mission, August 2005, just 9 years ago. Watch this thing. You can see something do a U-turn. This is sped up a bit from the original, just so it doesn't take you forever to watch. And by the way, that's Earth below. You'll see the bottom, the horizon of the Earth, the edge, in a moment there. This thing looks like it just turned around. Just turned around in space. What does that? Is that something that we can make? Maybe. Ours are not ours. That's a question. And I can't answer all of these. You know, what... Some people offer their opinion on what percentage of UFOs are man-made and not man-made. I don't know. I would confidently argue that at least a portion, or a large portion, are not man-made. Let me get my water here. What percentage? I don't know. I think the farther back we go in the sightings history, probably the larger that percentage is. I mean, we've had, going back to the 1940s and 50s, there were a number of very well-recorded sightings of objects. We're talking 1950, 1949. I've got 10 minutes. Great, thank you. Going at ultra-high speeds, ultra-high altitudes. It's kind of a reach to see some of these as human technology. I guess it's possible, but there hasn't really been a whole lot of strong evidence, in my opinion, indicating that we had these breakthroughs that early on. Not seeing it, personally. Now, today is another story. So I don't know what the percentage would be. I think that there's a substantial infrastructure on both sides of it. But this phenomenon gets even stranger than, lights in the sky and space-based observations and people on the moon and what have you. My own research has gone into some... I've encountered some strange stories. I guess I'll just say that. People come to me who've had encounters or what appear to be encounters with people who are not normal people. I've talked about this once in a while. I'll tell you one story. Woman grew up in western Pennsylvania in the 1960s in a tiny little town. Everyone knew everyone, especially in church, which is where this woman was on one occasion with her mother. Mid-1960s, she was in her mid-teens. And she sits down in church, and this blonde couple, male and female, sit in front of her. And she says they were the most unbelievably beautiful people she'd ever seen. They were the most incredible blue fabric that she had ever seen. She said, I looked carefully at the fabric. I'd never seen anything that fine and that incredible. And she's like, who are these people? They're the most obvious standing out people in this whole church. And she said, no one was looking at them. Why was no one looking at them? So she was fixated on them all through church, right, all through Mass. And then she said to me, and I heard them in my mind having conversation. And she said one thought to the other, well, we appear to be fitting in pretty well here. And the other one thought back, yes, except for the girl behind us who can hear us. Yeah, this lady, by the way, came to me with her husband, and she was like a sweet lady. She was, you know, almost 60. Normal life, seemed to me. And she just said, look, this is a totally puzzling experience I had. It didn't end there. So she got a little nervous after she heard that. And she didn't hear them anymore after that. So maybe they shut it down, whatever they did. She couldn't hear them thinking after that. And then Mass finally ended. And they were like in the middle of the church. And this couple got up and out and they were gone fast. ahead of the crowd somehow, and she had this moment of bravery, and she said to herself, I'm going after them. And so she gets out of the church, out of the aisle, and her mother, like all parents, totally oblivious to all the important things going on, says, get back here, young lady, where do you think you're going? And she just goes, and she pushes her way through the crowd. And she gets to the front of the church, and she sees the couple, and they've gone across the parking lot, they're going over this hill. They go down this hill. So she trots up ahead to catch up to them, and she gets to the hill where they were, and she sees them now across a field, and they're moving fast to this wooded area. And she starts down the hill, and then she stops dead in her tracks because she sees a third figure there that scared the heck out of her. She said to me, do you remember the character Lurch from the Addams Family TV show? She said he looked just like that guy. Very tall, unnaturally tall, very gangly, thin, black hat, black suit, and she stops. She's like, I don't want to go near this guy. So the blonde couple walks right up to this tall guy, like a tall man in black, basically, past him into the woods. He turns around, he follows him into the woods. That's her story. I had a very similar story told me by a retired Air Force colonel, PhD, and I'll just only give you the bare bones of this woman. He was with his wife and a friend of theirs who happened to be kind of like a psychic or they felt was a psychic. They were on having fun in Vegas at a casino. He was not on work time here. And the psychic grabs him on the arm and says, stop, stop. And she points to a blonde woman and says, she's not normal. She's not like us. And he looks over at her, and she's described as this like extremely beautiful woman wearing incredible clothing. Of course, it's Las Vegas, and you would see this, right? But there was something different. Something different. So the wife and this psychic friend go down the escalator. They're getting out of there. They're afraid. He's watching her for a moment. And he said to me, he's telling me the story on the other side of the country from where this Pennsylvania lady was. He says, I heard her in my mind. And she turned slightly, and he heard her thinking into his head. She's basically like a cop on the beat saying, nothing to see here. What do you think you're doing? Just go about your business. And he's startled. He's like, what is that? And then she's joined by this equally beautiful blonde man, equally well-dressed. They're obviously together. And they start walking toward him. And he's thinking, great, I'm going to talk to them. I'm going to say something. I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm going to say something. Well, they walk right by him. He says nothing. He gets behind them on the escalator as they're going down. And he hears them, he says, this is a conversation, thinking to each other. They're not talking. And the conversation is essentially, yeah, he hears us. No big deal. He's not part of anything important. Just ignore him. He'll go away. That's the end of it. And then they get to the bottom and they just leave. A lot of other stories I've encountered from people who have had, it's very clear that they've been observed. They've been monitored. There's this clandestine infrastructure that's out there. This is, who are these people? Well, let me wrap this up. I've only got about 5 minutes. This is what I think is happening. This is my current state of the union, as it were. I think we had retrievals of exotic technologies and bodies. That is, I think that they are extraterrestrial. That's my assessment at this point. This was very important. This had to be kept absolutely secret at all costs. Necessity for absolute secrecy. The creation of black budgets as a result, creating secret technology programs that become a runaway system that goes private. The best way to keep the secret is you privatize it, make it proprietary. That makes it impervious to government requests and all of that. It's off limits. And by the way, private world's where the money is. That's where the power is. They're the people who control the political institutions anyway. So it all goes private. We all know that. Creating illegal and really criminal financing of the programs. That's all necessary. Creating what we would call a breakaway civilization, both in terms of technology and in terms of legality. Because what they're doing, they're breaking away from our entire national legal structures around the world. They're creating a transnational system on behalf of the very, very top few corporations and financial powers for their own benefit so that they are not answerable to you or me or ordinary people. They are answerable only to themselves, and they're going to be controlling this technology for their own use. And they're going to control this knowledge for their own power. In partly a desperate attempt to catch up to whatever these other beings are. My feeling is the arrival of these others, at least in our open conscious awareness, is such that this was considered by some of these people to be a very grave challenge to the whole structure, the whole ball of wax here. And what they're trying to do is desperately try to catch up, Whether they are actually able to catch up or not is another thing, but this is the attempt. Hiding all the breakthroughs, energy breakthroughs, propulsion breakthroughs, and much more. Things that would liberate this civilization of ours in so many critical ways. I mean, just imagine what we would be able to do with electrogravitics out in the open. Imagine what we could accomplish with something like clean, free energy. Just think about that. How that would absolutely, totally transform our civilization in ways that we cannot even possibly imagine, except that it would free up humanity in ways that are just, would be off the charts, off the charts. So what they have is a paralysis, disclosure paralysis, let us call it. One gentleman who very clearly was a legit black budget kind of insider wrote to me a few months ago and said, look, you know, your thoughts on disclosure are well and good, but you have to appreciate just the seriousness of disclosure to these people because they're all terrified of criminal proceedings against them. It's like the number one thing. To have immunity from prosecution is a prerequisite for anyone talking. And by the way, getting Congress to move on this is, I mean, that's a nice thing to do, but I have a feeling we're going way beyond Congress. That colonel who had the experience with the blonde beings in Las Vegas casino also did a deathbed interview about 10 years ago with a man who was apparently a Roswell, an original Roswell military recovery person back in 1947, who was now dying at 10 years ago. This colonel interviewed him and said at one point, it's really a shame that you're not able to tell the world about your experiences. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a presidential executive order to liberate you from your oath of secrecy? And this dying man almost chuckled. He said, it would take a hell of a lot more than a presidential executive order to liberate me from my oath. So you take that for what it's worth. These people are at such risk. They know how serious this is, and they know how vulnerable and exposed they would be if this whole thing were opened up to them. If this whole thing were opened up, and where would they be? I mean, some people would want to defend them, but a lot of people would want to imprison them. But they're not just afraid for their own sorry behinds. They're terrified. The people who own them are really terrified, I think, of the whole global transformation. This is big stuff. And we down here, we little plebes, we want the change. We know it's going to help us. Those people at the top, they have no incentive. I'm sure they feel they have way too much to lose, and they, like the managers of this program, might be liable to some blowback. What are their goals? Just about wrapping up here, so I think I'll finish on time. They want to formalize this structure right now. This is a big, important part of their agenda. So, you know, creating NAFTA and GATT and TPPA and TAFTA and all of these, it's not simply to consolidate financial control over the world. Yes, of course they want to do that. But they're trying to consolidate their independence from, again, from national laws, so that you and I do not have the ability any longer to legislate, to have any kind of legislation that's meaningful to them. They don't want that. They're trying to create transnational, corporate-friendly legal structures. As I said before, they want to enforce intellectual property rights, and hence no free file sharing, no bill. You know, I almost feel like an evangelist for 3D printing at times. I really believe that 3D printing can revolutionize our world. I've been saying this for a little while. You know, 3D printing. You can download a 3D design, and you can print off a nice little coffee mug or a little iPhone case or whatever. Well, future generation 3D printers are going to be a lot better than that, for sure. They'll do mixed materials. They'll do printed circuit boards. They'll do organic materials. Think about it 10, 20 years from now. Will you be able to 3D print some smart person's device for an energy, you know, like an energy harvesting device, what we call free energy, that would allow you to go off the grid? Yeah, I think so. I don't see why not. Do that. Think about how much freedom you'll have. Well, what's being put into place right now is a transnational legal structure to prevent things like this from happening. And it's a race. We're in a race right now. So before everything becomes completely consolidated, preventing us from making these breakthroughs, you know, we're racing against the clock and for our technology to allow ourselves to make some of these breakthroughs. I think we're going to win. What are their other goals, though? They want a goal of total surveillance. They're doing that. They want a goal of total intimidation. You will continue to have the right to bitch. You're not going to have the right to do a whole lot more than that. You know, that's the sum total of your freedom of speech these days. organizing. And the thing is, when people know they're being surveilled, whether they're through email or on the street corners, it does have an intimidating effect against a lot of people. Not everyone, but a lot of people who would ordinarily protest are not going to protest because they're just afraid. And that's the whole goal. It's intimidation. It's control. It's surveillance. And the other thing they want to do is turn the web into TV. We're seeing this now with the arguments over net neutrality. We're going to continue to see these arguments over the coming years. That is the attempt to create a multi-tier system of internet that's going increasingly to work against independent alternative research sources on the web. You know, they're not going to eliminate it all at once. They're just going to squeeze them out bit by bit, year after year. They're going to attempt to make it more and more difficult through this type of harassment. So that then your web, you turn out like Yahoo News, that is news for Yahoos, basically have the latest Miley Cyrus twerking scandal, whatever. And they do this for a reason, of course. They have to distract you. They have to make you, basically the whole point of that is to make you sit down and shut up and maybe bitch a little bit and let off some steam every now and then, but that's essentially it. So the web, they want to turn into just television, spoon feed, like back in the 1980s when, you know, we had Full House to watch and great shows like that. Before there was a web. So they want to maintain total control over global intellectual life. That's not an outrageous statement. That sounds like what a big thing he's saying. It's not. It's not over the top to say this. They want total control over global intellectual life. That's what totalitarianism is. That's what this whole secrecy over the UFOs is just a big umbrella term for all of this that we're dealing with. We're talking about others. We're talking about a breakaway civilization. We're talking about something that's so transformative that they must control it. And to control it, the only way they can do it is to create a global totalitarianism. Control every aspect of your life that matters. And beyond that, I believe, I fear, and I think they may be trying, down the road, some version of what we might call class-based transhumanism. You know what I mean. We're at a point now where we've got total control, or we're getting total control over genetic material, genetic manipulation, DNA, moving into an age of advanced nanotech, an age of advanced artificial intelligence. There's a lot of potentialities here that no one could dream of even 10 years ago, including the creation of a super race. It's really not. I mean, there are people, they've got to be thinking about this. So, I mean, they're already creating it now, basically creating dumb-dumb America, dumb-dumb Canada, dumb-dumb Europe, with programming, fluoridation, toxins in the water, all the things that dumb us down. They're already doing that, but I think would be ideal for them is to formalize that, where you literally will have a race of people who've got longer lives, more intelligence, better physical strength, and then a race of people maybe who don't have those things. It sounds truly nightmarish. It is nightmarish. Is it possible? Yes, of course it's possible. And just, you know, it's not happening yet. But this is the kind of nightmare world we could be moving into. But I don't think it's necessarily going to go that way. I think this system is inherently unstable. I think this system is inherently ready to just go down. It's on outrageous thievery. It's on outrageous injustice. It's built on a total unsustainable model. We're seeing dramatic changes in our own society. Can this be like France before the revolution? Can this be like Russia before the revolution? The answer is yes, it can be. I'm not saying it will be, and I'm not saying go do it. I'm saying it can be. And the other thing is with disclosure, there's no easy way to do this. There's no easy way to ease into the truth here. This is such a dramatic upside-down reality that we're living in that if this stuff comes out in any way, you know, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be gradual. One thing that I would just ask you to think about before I truly wrap this up is ask yourself a question. Will we ever be able to deal with whoever these other beings are who I think appear to be interacting with humanity in one form or another here on Earth? You know, it's a quiet enough of a presence now, but you talk to someone who thinks that they've had an experience and ask them how easy it is for them. Not everyone's had a very positive experience. Some have had positive experiences, others have not. A number have not. I've been thinking about how we win lately. I was very fortunate to be part of the citizen hearings on disclosure organized by Stephen Bassett, who's here today. That was a great honor for me. We got to speak for a week in front of six retired members of U.S. Congress about the profundity of the UFO phenomenon. And you could see over the course of a week how these people really transformed in their own opinions about this subject. I could see it. Political action is something that we must continue to employ in a way to create change in this world. But I'm hesitant to engage in like any kind of invective against the powers that be or establishment. Because really all that I think that's going to do is just cause a kind of a reaction and a closing of ranks. What I think a better model for me, the more I think about it, is creating a culture of change. And I know that sounds a little wishy-washy, but just hear me out here. Think about a guy like Oscar Wilde, who a little over 100 years ago spent his last years in jail because he happened to be gay and happened to be in a situation where his society said, that's abominable, that's an abomination, right? So we go from that through the 20th century. And how did that transformation in our cultural attitudes about people who happen to be gay take place? It's mainly by having a few brave people deciding to come out. And they had to come out before anyone else did. And they said, screw it, I don't really care. This is who I am. You got to accept me. And they were role models for other people who then came out. And who then came out after them and more and more and more. And the next thing you know, hey, we're in a different culture. And the next thing you know, within a space of 15 years, America's attitude on gay marriage totally flip-flops from 70-30 against to like probably, I don't know, what is it, 80-24 now? Whatever. You know? It's a total rapid sea change. That is the most profound level of change. And we are right now in a period of cultural change on a lot of matters, including this one. I've seen it myself over 20 years. I've seen this change. So what I believe is it's actual personal bravery more than anything else that will create this change. It's having things like this on YouTube. It's having groups of people getting together and talking about this in ways and liberating themselves mentally and emotionally and showing the way for other people to liberate themselves mentally and emotionally. In Rochester, New York, where I happen to live, I've been an active member of a UFO meetup group for the last 6 years. It's like my extra family. I love those people. And we have 50, 60 people minimum every month, and we get together, and we bring new people in all the time. And I think this is I think meetup.com is a great website, a great idea, and you yourself can start one wherever you live. It's a great way to kind of create a center of gravity, as it were, and to give yourself a sense of community, which is absolutely necessary if you're going to make cultural change. It's one thing to talk to people on the web, but as you're seeing here at this event, it's a totally different experience when you're face-to-face with somebody. It's totally different. And it's energizing. And you have to have that because we're not robots. We're human beings. And we need that emotional connection to other people to create true change. We need that sense of community. So for me, Meetup is a good one. And meeting people at conferences like this is also very, very effective. Remember that there's three stages that every new radical, revolutionary, transformative idea goes through, right? First, they ridicule you. Then they attack you. And then they say, oh, yeah, we knew that all along. And I think that's right. Another thing that I feel we have to remind ourselves doing is to the extent that it is reasonable for us, to the extent that it is feasible for us, is not to participate in this type of criminal system that is trying to have total control over us. So do not participate in the mainstream 24/7 propaganda mind job that's being done on you when you turn on your television. Just don't participate. Don't participate in the kinds of ritualistic forms of control like these the election cycles and the presidential this and that and the other thing. This is a system of control. Don't participate in a kind of obsession over your local sports team and the Super Bowl and the World Series. I mean, like, I grew up playing baseball, and I love the game. But it's a different thing for me to play it than to watch it in some corporate-dominated media setting, because all it does is it just grabs your brain and goes, and rips it out of your head. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. If you have... Thank you. I have two kids. They're in their late teens now. I homeschooled my kids for years. I'll tell you, that was a lot of work, but it was the most rewarding thing I did. And I've got two young people now who have their own minds, And they know, and they're not, you know, my son's Miley Cyrus knowledge is a little lacking, but, you know, he's a genius. And my daughter's an off-the-charts amazing young woman. They think for themselves, and I'm a believer in homeschooling. I just think doing things to allow a certain level of independence from the control system, this is what we want to keep this in mind to the extent possible, and showing other people that it's also possible. And being brave about this subject is very, very key. Well, I think I was supposed to end my lecture a minute ago, but I just want to. I'm amazed that I came as close to the target as I have. I'm going to be available at my table if you want to chat with me about this afterward. I'll be signing some books, and I'll certainly be available at the across the way there. I just want to thank you so very much for your time here today. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Great. Thank you. Should I get this down here?
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Great. Great stuff. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, we're just going to take 10 minutes, short break, get some air. We'll try to get some air in the hall here, okay? We'll start up in 10 minutes, though, right from now, so be here on time. We'll start without you, if not.